Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program where we get to meet the people that make a difference in our lives and in our community. I am your host, Bob Willard, and today our guest is Kim Walker, a virtuoso bassoonist and gifted teacher of master classes at IU and all over the world. She is also Associate Dean of the Faculties and Chair of the IU Arts Coordinating Council. For the next hour or so, we will ask Kim a few questions, play some music, and meet the person behind the persona. Kim, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you.
Kim, let me introduce you to our listeners by mentioning some of your accomplishments. Not only is she one of the most sought-after bassoonists in the world, but she has become one of the most sought-after teachers. And her commissions include works by some of the greatest composers living today. Her full, interdisciplinary, holistic approach to and involvement with the world of music, as well as fluency in several languages, highlights some of the many facets that have made her career remarkable. A recent review of her work said, "Everything you have heard about Kim Walker is true. She is vivacious, possessed of a ravishing tone, and to speak of technical command seems superfluous." Kim, when did you realize you wanted to make music your life's work?
Well, Bob, I think I was 14, and I had been already 1 year at Interlochen Arts Academy, the high school, the private section. And as I was sitting there playing Vaughan Williams' Mask for Dancing Job, conducted by Thor Johnson, who at the time seemed to me like a Leonard Bernstein, who I met later years, and there's no resemblance, let me tell you. I just had this incredible feeling, whether you call it epiphany, I called it a washover at the time, and I just knew that this is exactly what I wanted to do, be involved in music, performing for the rest of my life. There was just no more discussion, and the rest of my life was really focused. I actually intended to go to a normal university program in Boston, and on the spur of the moment, Sal Schoenbach called up and said, "We didn't have any places at Curtis, but I heard you this summer at Marlboro, and we do have a place. Would you like to come?" So really, age 14, I already ended up being focused into from Interlochen Arts Academy into Curtis Institute, and this opened many tremendous doors.
Now, when did you go to Curtis? At 14?
No, at 14 I was at Interlochen Arts Academy.
Yes.
And Sal Schoenbach came to visit in the summer to give a master class. He then invited me to Marlboro to study with him privately at age 16. The next year, he invited me to participate, and then they invited me to Curtis. Rudolf Serkin virtually created a place because there weren't any openings that year. So I was extremely lucky due to many generous teachers and people all along the way.
You seem to have skipped a few steps in there somehow or another.
Several.
Let's go back a ways. We understand that you were 14, but you had been playing music in a number of different instruments, as I understand, up until then. And I assume then your parents were supportive of your training and your vocational calling.
Absolutely. You know, we started this, you know, when was the moment that I knew for sure? I tried everything. I was involved in the arts. My mother's in the dance world. She today is a dean at the State University of New York in Purchase. My father was a Scottish tenor who went into education as well. So every Sunday morning we'd wake up with McCormick and Caruso followed by the Highland Bagpipes. And if you weren't marching by noon, I don't know what else would work. But it was true between my mother's avant-garde tastes in music with Ives and Schoenberg and were far removed from what my father wanted to listen to the Mozart horn concerto. So there was a vast repertoire always available in terms of a daily appetite of music as a youngster. When I wanted to begin, I began on cello, which was really perhaps my greatest love. I was very curious what this white, bobbling white halo at the back of the orchestra was, and I met this bassoonist, and he had all these reed knives and tools, and curiosity got the better of me, so I said, "Well, I'd like to play one of those, thank you." And the reed making I do find fascinating. It's kind of like origami. It's a bit of a meditation, sitting there taking a piece of bamboo and finding the right shape and letting it vibrate. And I've always enjoyed that as my quiet time of the week. So I gravitated to bassoon and cello. And as the educational programs needed a double bass here or a saxophonist there or a bass clarinetist there or whatever, I actually played clarinet and about 12 instruments, as we do as youngsters. One day, age 14, I was in the Interlochen Summer Academy, and I asked if I could attend the annual year-long academy, arts academy, my parents said, you're much too young to go leave home, and maybe we'll think about it for a year from now. And, of course, we didn't even own a bassoon, and the plastic bassoon I was playing on, the keys kept falling off, and it was a bit of a nightmare. I guess I do like challenges, perhaps too much. I was also playing cello at that point. Well, at the end of the summer, I was called up on stage and awarded a full tuition scholarship to Interlaken Arts Academy on one condition, as a bassoonist. So my choice was made slightly. And having played on a beautiful cello in the Chicago area and string quartets with Francis Akosh's daughter and members of the Chicago Symphony, I used to sneak into the Ravinia Music Festival through I knew the back way through a hole in the fence with my bicycle. I'd listen to all the rehearsals all the time. Anyway, that's another story. But as I was going to Interlaken, I said, well, I'll keep playing string quartets and I'll play bassoon in the orchestra and I'll have piano lessons and then I'll do my academics in the morning. Wrong. They gave me this Roth cello, which was a box, and it wasn't nearly as friendly as this beautiful cello I'd been lent in Chicago. And I was playing 5 days a week in the orchestra, not once a week. So I really started at that point to gravitate. And then 2 months in or so, I guess it really was, we had this marvelous moment where I just sat there and I said, this is just extraordinary. How could, you know, I mean, I knew exactly what I was going to do and I was going to follow up and play on the bassoon. So I don't know if it's the double reed bagpipe that's in my DNA. That's really the direction I finally proceeded in to specialize.
You mentioned that you had a plastic bassoon.
That was an improvement over the first one. They had a Chinese bassoon and I sat there. Actually, I got into bassoon because they wanted a bassoonist for West Side Story at the high school. And I was in 6th or 7th grade, and I played bass clarinet rather well for a 6th grader. Okay, let's put this not in IU terms. Thank you.
Okay.
So all of a sudden, they wanted somebody to play the bassoon. They said, well, Kim's quick, and maybe she could do this. Well, there's a top E in West Side Story, which I'm told Leonard Bernstein put in there to assure his friend Lenny Hindell from the New York Philharmonic a place because it was in their younger days, and Lenny wasn't very rich and needed a gig. So he made it just too high for any saxophonist by adding this one note, which was actually unplayable by 90% of the bassoonists at the time anyway, but we didn't tell anyone. So the bassoonists all had a gig in this West Side Story, and it's the kind of rumbling, rhythmic, playful tunes. The next piece they scheduled at the high school, because that was a success, was The Soldier's Tale by Stravinsky. So these were my initiations to playing the bassoon, not scales or long tones like I insist with my own students, but two of the hardest pieces I could imagine in the repertoire technically. So nobody told me it was difficult. I didn't know. I just started practicing, and we did 7 performances of The Soldier Tale. It must have been quite diabolical at moments, but that's my role in there, the dance of the devil. So it seemed to work. I ended up in the hospital with mono after that, but no, it was absolutely a fantastic experience, and I would go up to the high school every afternoon in the public school system. And after that is when my parents relented and said, well, maybe you could try Interlaken for the summer. And when I finally left home, it wasn't such a different thing because probably they had a lot less time driving. They must have had some time to, you know, eat and talk to each other. We would schedule our visits, you know, as we do now. It's holiday time. I'll meet you somewhere.
Well, The Soldier's Tale is tough. I mean, that must have been quite a high school group to be able to play that, not only the bassoon, but the trumpet.
Do you know it was? And actually, Gary Sinise was in this, and several other people who are major producers in the performance world. They had a tremendous performance, a theatrical department at this high school. The suburb I lived, Highland Park, right next to Ravinia, just the arts were a very important part of education. And my mother was the choreographer with all of these wonderful people, and they had tremendous musical director at the high school. And they took this ambitious project to bring in dance, drama, and music all on stage. And I have no idea if the traditions are still maintained, but for many years they would always put on these annual shows.
It was almost like a high school of the arts in a way then, wasn't it?
It
or at
was.
Least it gave you that opportunities.
It did, and then perhaps I just wanted to go one step farther than going up to Interlaken.
Okay, then from Interlaken, you went to Curtis.
I did.
But you skipped sort of the college thing? You just went straight to Curtis?
I kept trying. I was offered the full scholarship to Yale and Boston University, and I was all headed in that direction, either for law or mathematics, and I would also play music. I was going to be a very good, broad-minded person someday in life. Even though I'd had this washover, I never really doubted I would end up performing. I just wasn't sure to what extent. So when I got this phone call from Sal Schoenbach a week before university began saying, well, I just talked to Rudolf Serkin, and he says, you know, we have a place for you. And he had the most incredible accent and tone to his voice. He's probably the most colorful character who influenced my life as a teacher and musician. And anyway, he said, well, if you'd like to come, we have a place, and it's all free. So how could you say no? I mean, this was the greatest opportunity. So we sent the trunk to Curtis. And I had very extraordinary lessons there for 2 years with Sal Schoenbach. For example, he would walk in with a box of books on the third week. And I'm saying, you know, he's had three heart attacks. What's he carrying this box for? He drops it on the floor and says, you kids are all illiterate. I expect to talk to you about these books in a week. So we'd have Dostoevsky and we'd have Dylan, and everybody was in this book. And sure enough, he didn't forget. He knew exactly. And he sometimes would take me out for lunch and he'd quote, you know, and ask who what it was from, and I'd be quizzed more on the books. And by the way, the bassoon is like this. He was impossible. He never gave a technical explanation for anything. All was in images and creating from inside what we were going to work on. So the next week, a few weeks later, he'd say, we're going shopping. And I'd show up, and what we were doing, we were going to the art museum, and we'd be talking with his wife, would be explaining art and light and painting and textures to me. So he got very worried that if we didn't have a broad experience of life, and he saw to it that there were all kinds of extracurricular activities outside of Curtis. So while I was there learning solfege in French and working hard with everyone else, terrified of every chamber music lesson and every lesson, just, you know, at that stage of life where it's a real challenge to try and do what you're wanting to do. After 2 years, there were political tensions there. So instead of staying around, I shot off to Europe for the next 18 years, really. I was going for 1 year, and I was meant to come back. I just never did.
Well, I'd like to get into the holistic education type thing, the philosophy, a little bit later. But what I thought now is, do you have some music that you have played that we could listen to?
Absolutely. One of the pieces which won the Grolmeyer Award recently is a work I'm very excited about by Simon Bainbridge, Ad Ora Incerta. We kicked around the poetry to be used for really 3 to 6 months with Brigitte Fassbender, because he came to visit me to write a bassoon concerto, and I said, you know, we're just beginning a series with singers, and Brigitte Fassbender's up here teaching. Would you like to have lunch with us? We all got along fabulously, and in the end, having tried several very interesting authors, he settled on the poems Primo Levi about the same time I was in Geneva reading them, about to call him. So we had these emails and phones. I'm not sure we had email. It was fax at the time. Crossings, all saying the same, have you seen these poems by Rilke that Primo Levi was interested in? And we'd all found them at these funny bookshops. That was just too serendipitous to ignore. And Simon really set up these poems in a very astute manner, where the bassoon is an integral voice. Brigitte actually wanted some speaking roles and merging in out of a normal voice to a husky voice into singing. Ultimately, this came at a time where Brigitte Fassbender actually was retiring from singing, which was very upsetting because we'd actually rehearsed everything. In the meantime, we did perform it, and it has won the Grolmeyer Award, and you have here today the recording we made with Martin Brabbins and the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Susan Bickley singing.
And what movement will we be listening to?
We'll be listening to Lunedì. And this is, I asked him for a modern Vivaldi concerto. In other words, something with that incredible atmosphere, with a very slow movement, where the bassoon is saying something very expressive in almost a Japanese timeless manner, but with this underlying some kind of tension from the strings. This is what it came in. It's the most amazing interface between voice and bassoon, because we have just one note and we keep moving in these intervals at the same time in a parallel rhythmic structure. But when you're with a singer, they're going to go at a split second. And to really guess this is heart-rendering. We only did two takes and they took one or the other because to start splicing it was going to actually lose that incredible tension of not quite being perfect because it's human. So anyway, I hope you'll enjoy this as much as we did.
Our guest today is Kim Walker, bassoonist virtuoso. And what we have just heard is a piece by Simon Bainbridge that you commissioned or just played. And can you explain again what the Grawemeyer Award is?
I actually commissioned it, and then we arranged for the BBC Symphony to pay for most of that commission instead of us, which was the – it works rather differently in London, and you'll find there's much more funding for composers and grants available based on who will perform it. So it was a healthy sum of money. So we were delighted when they took up the commission. And what you just heard was Lunedì, one movement of a four-movement piece, a major work of 35 minutes called Ad Ora Incerta, which is written by Simon Bainbridge and uses poetry by Primo Levi. And this piece won the Grawemeyer Award, perhaps the largest sum of money and prestige for a composer in the business. The Grawemeyer Award, which Simon won because of this extraordinary piece of music, is probably the largest award that I know of in the music business. It's $150,000, at least for a composer. And then they bring Louisville. It's in Louisville, down the road. Then they have a great activity, a great focus on modern music in the university program there. So they bring the award winner as a guest lecturer or faculty member of some establishment or some relationship for the next 2 years. So it promotes the university, the local community. They're there talking, teaching. So it enriches their whole life in the musical life, I should say, of the community. And it's been used as a marvelous tool. And the composers over the years have gone on to establish themselves, if they weren't already, even, you know, more prominently.
It's a nice thing to get then.
I think he was thrilled.
You mentioned earlier that you had were working with singers. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, I'd love to. It's been one of my actually, I think the smartest thing I did was team up with a good manager and be very entrepreneurial in my career because a bassoon is never like a violin or a cello or piano, the great – or voice. I mean, the aristocrats of this business. So this country bumpkin bassoon arrives and they say, what do you do with that? I'm a manager. What can you play? There's only two concertos. And we say, well, there really are 40, but we're not talking Brahms and Beethoven. We're talking Strauss and Weber and Villa-Lobos and let's get creative here. So when I – was offered management by two or three sources. I, on my second go, really got it right. I took a young man who was very entrepreneurial himself, and I said, we need to approach this differently. We need to create time and energy in the schedule so that we have enough money available to do projects of interest and not be driven by running out to do every recital in every music society that takes 8 hours on the train and get back. I do need experience, absolutely, and we're going to organize this. But what we did was we started fundraising almost immediately for certain projects, and we became very good at this, actually, to the point that we ended up running a festival, actually a few festivals together, and we became then consultants for the major Schleswig-Holstein in Germany on how to organize chamber music festival and one in France. But we set up in a country manor home in England, in Cheshire. We found a summer home that was always empty and had about 40 rooms available, and the lovely actually it was a drawing room for a painter, so it had beautiful light just adjacent to the home and the car. And then we asked Rolls-Royce if they wanted to sponsor bringing some of the world's greatest divas and opera singers to, as if those two aren't synonymous, I'm not sure, bringing them to teach. And what we did was we pursued very actively bringing performers who were so busy performing that they weren't teaching. And at the time, that was almost myself. I really only taught 4 or 5 students because I didn't have much more time. I was home less than 2 months of the year with performances. So we really got together and made a list. And then John Barry himself really went out and contacted these people. It took 2 years to set up. But we brought Thomas Hampson. We brought Birgit Nielsen, who was unbelievably entertaining and brilliant, Brigitte Fassbender and Renata Scotto to begin. That was enough to convince Rolls-Royce they should sponsor it. They picked everybody up in a Rolls at the airport, myself included. I mean, I felt like I was, you know, going to the plaza, shall we say. Then we had brought in some of the great wind players that we could, you know, really solicit. So I met Jean Rousseau from Indiana University. Probably the start of my connection being here in Bloomington. Maurice Borg for oboe, Jimmy Galway and Peter Lucas Graf for flute. Anyway, a host of very colorful figures, because that's really the way to launch things. And the first year we did everything in four color and almost lost our shirt, of course. And actually by the third year we didn't need to publicize and it was full with professional players only. So the advantage of doing this was not only that it gave us time in our schedules and income for other types of projects that with a bassoon one needs to undertake, but I was able to watch for several years running the master classes of these great singers. And what were they talking about? What were they hearing? Why did they want a different vowel? What color? And then why did they have to be so healthy to sing? You know, how important is the body? And it became very clear by the second year we had Alexander technique involved as free to all participants. We had a shiatsu, a Japanese master come and do in warm-ups. Now, can you imagine opera singers getting up at 6 in the morning and 4 p.m. after tea? So it became 5 o'clock. It was a bit English suggestion of time, shall we say. Sitting there on the floor on mats doing their stretches, putting their fingers between their toes and pulling. The first 2 days they said, we're not getting up at that hour. By the end of the week, it was packed every time because those that would try this came and were singing so vibrantly and so passionately. Everybody said, I'm going to try it. Whatever it is, it's working. We brought in a psychologist. We brought in somebody actually 1 year to talk a little bit about science and what is going on with the cosmos and the world and energies. So then we brought in an astrologer and astronomy person together one year. And we found that people were more interested in all of these auxiliary subjects because it helped them think in a larger format about energy. Energy in motion, which is emotion, which is really what we're communicating so often as a performer from the inside out. So the better we could make them feel, the happier, the more comfortable, and whatever they needed. That we had massage, of course, the whole time. But why were these relative and what was working, what didn't work? We learned a lot about what was superfluous and what was the essential in all of these ingredients. The photocopy machine was still the most important ingredient of the week, but it was a wonderful interdisciplinary learning experience. Because of that, I actually made good friends with many of these people involved. Now, not everybody was interested in this. Some of the famous ones thought this was absolute rubbish. Some of them thought this was the greatest thing that, you know, they'd ever come to and gave their money back, which is another reason it started building up an endowment. 7 years later, when I came to Bloomington, we kept it going for 1 or 2 years, but I found that I couldn't do it alone. And John Barry was then director and still is at the English National Opera, and he couldn't do it alone. Again, it's often as two people or two organs in the body spark off the third, which is really the excitement. So it's often a chemistry of who you're working with that's so important.
But you learned a lot about playing the bassoon from watching singers?
Absolutely. Head resonance, body resonance. I learned that in the end, it's really our body that's involved as a woodwind instrument. The reed is inside the body. I don't have a string outside of the body that's going to vibrate and resonate. It's inside, and we've got to give an air pulsation in a way that will create this resonance or this sense of diminuendo and decay, which gives a life and a shape to a note, and then another impulse, which will create the next movement. And do you sing through a phrase? It's all about the breathing. So in essence, it was a wonderful experience because now I've been asked to go give master classes on breathing and breath control and all of these exercises we explored in that week. I can do it in an hour, the ones that were successful, instead of taking the week to experiment on you, shall we say. But I went off to Sweden and Germany to participate with some of these world-class singers, and I would be there for 3 days just working on breathing techniques with the singers. So it taught me a lot as a teacher. It also taught me a lot as a performer. And really, I can't imagine performing without teaching or teaching without performing.
I want to touch on one thing that you sparked my curiosity. When you said that a singer and an instrumentalist playing in duet, that
yes,
they were always a hair ahead or something like that.
The time to prepare on a bassoon, because it's inside, it's like you take up an elevator and then you have to get out at floor 11. If you get out at 10 and 3 quarters, it's not going to be the right frequency. But when two people, it's totally telepathic, really. And we're standing a good 35 feet away from the orchestra so they can separate our sound. So everybody's kind of staring at everybody intently, like, are you going to move right now? Or, but when you get to that millisecond, right, where is it? You can't kind of blend over. In this piece we just heard, it was electrifying because you don't see the singer moving a finger. You don't see the singer waving around. And so it was really by just looking in the eyes, knowing exactly when they're going to go. And performances, we're both staring ahead, looking beautifully at the audience. You're not there. So it's sort of from behind. The back feels this. In fact, if you work with blind people, which I did in Switzerland, deaf blind people, they hear by their back vibration. And I learned that really you have to feel it. So you have to sense completely when they're going to move. And for them, it's just they're going to shift something, but we have to prepare the air, the key movement. It's a slightly longer, maybe I'm a second and they're a tenth of a second. So to anticipate that and fit that into the coordination was actually much more difficult than I realized it might be.
Just that millisecond difference, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, that's the real challenge.
Well, you talked about starting this festival.
Yes.
Well, that leads directly into Arts Week, which is coming up here at IU and which you're involved with.
Absolutely. It's one of my great joys being at the Dean of Faculties. First of all, it's an honor to work there, but it's a real pleasure to meet so many people from across all areas of the campus. And one of the duties and services in the office is really organizing Arts Week. This is going to be the 18th annual Arts Week. I cannot think of any other committee that's still in organized and in the same shape after 18 years on this campus. Maybe you know of some, but for myself, I was very impressed that it's still happening after 18 years. It's the only committee I know where we have invited some board of directors from the foundation. We have alumni. We have students. We have faculty. We have staff. We have all areas of the university interests covered. Probably somebody will call up tomorrow and say, I'm not on your committee. But really, we've tried and we've expanded. In terms of the city, this is wonderful because we have people from the city council, people from all of the arts areas are represented. They can participate. If they show any interest, they're on the committee. And what we did, because it becomes a large group of 40 people, I divided it into an arts advisory group to discuss what should we be doing conceptually, where do we want to take this, and the publicity and marketing specialists to advise on what is the best approach with the budget each year or what is the long-term approach. And this has helped a lot. It's been a lot of work this year for a lot of these people because it had its own system and we changed that. But it's, I think, helped because in the past there have been moments of alienation between community and Town of Gown. What's really happened is we've turned that around, fostering and recognizing all of the great creativity in this town. And we've turned Arts Week really into a showcase of the best and the most exciting work in the creative and performing arts that's going around in Bloomington and at Indiana University. If you take everything from the intimate theater and local playwrights of the Bloomington Playwrights Project, and you go all the way up to the very stirring artistry of all of our IU Grammy Award winners and this incredible world-class faculty, you put all that together, and I find that Bloomington as a town, it just always continues to offer really memorable experiences in virtually every style of theater, performing arts, and creative expression, creative minds. And this intrigue and this challenge of the artistry is really one of the signatures of Bloomington. So Arts Week, I think, has taken on a prominence at the city level and at the university with all the interest in the arts and humanities. And now's the time. So we're trying to really showcase this.
That's in February?
It's coming up. We set the weekend of February 22nd to 25th to correspond with, again, an event of campus-wide significance each year versus setting a date, and everybody had to fit their curriculum into that date. So on February 22nd, we opened the Ruth N. Halls Theater in this brand-new theater complex, which opened the Neil Marshall Grand Hall, and the celebrations are ongoing with the Metz Theater there. There's also the opening night of Death of a Salesman, directed by Howard Jensen. There's The Bartered Bride, conducted by David Efron and the IU Opera. There's The Rites of Antigone. I mean, there's a host of five evening events. So we're hoping people come to this reception at 6 p.m. on the 22nd of February. The mayor will join us. We will have some performances, food and beverages, but it's a celebration for all those who are participating. And then hopefully they'll segue into a series of events. It actually starts with a preview as of the 14th of February. There's so many areas of the university, it's impossible in a weekend to represent them all. And it goes through March 2nd.
There's going to be a lot. It's not just music. It's dance. It's art.
Absolutely. I mean,
it's visual arts. It's
And there's even a writer's symposium. The college is sponsoring that.
I'm ready for a break. How
Good.
About some more music?
All right. Let's liven things up perhaps with the Flight of the Bumblebee.
The Rimsky-Korsakov on a bassoon?
It sounds like a hornet, but yes, it's, it's very much less dangerous.
Let's hear it. Flight of the Bumblebee by Rimsky-Korsakov, played by Kim Walker on the bassoon with Julius Drake as her collaborator.
This is the word, absolutely. He's a wonderful pianist.
You mentioned the epiphany of when you were 14 during the Job. You seem to have had a few others, and one of them that brought you here almost, if you could just sort of touch on those.
Okay. Well, there have actually been three major epiphanies in life, and there may have been a fourth that I'm ignoring. We don't know. But the one was actually mountain climbing. I've done a lot with being out of doors, and for me, being outside and breathing fresh air is just part of life's great pleasures, and it's a real privilege. So we were up in the mountains in Zermatt, and four musicians and a guide, and everybody was chomping to go up this mountain, and I said, I don't think it's a good idea. We woke up the next morning, and two of us said, we have a terrible feeling. We really don't think we should go up today. And everybody said, if it's beautiful weather when we get to the top, because we were all clouded in, let's go. So we did, and it was beautiful sun. You couldn't ask for better. And they looked at me and said, what are we going to do now? I said, well, one against five, I know what we're going to do. So we walked across this crevasse, which I was quite calm. You know, we did that off very often every week, and I would go up in the mountains when I was home if I could, and had probably toured across the Alps with my dog in my rucksack, covered most of the trails across the Alps, shall we say. So it wasn't frightening from that point of view. It just was another adventure. And we did this, and we're climbing up Castor and Pollux, and sure enough, the perfect storm, not quite like the film, but the one for the mountains that was on the other side of the Matterhorn, came right over the top of the mountain. We couldn't see 5 inches, and it was complete whiteout. And what was another 9 to 12 hour story, I'll try and put into 2 minutes or less, because basically there was an accident and we fell about 350 meters into a crevasse. And I will never in my life forget that moment of bouncing down the mountain and then all of a sudden realizing I was bouncing no longer but going in. And it was extraordinary. And we landed on an ice shelf that was no larger than this studio, 7 feet wide and 6 feet long. And everybody was there. And 2 were unconscious and weren't. And so in the end, had to empty out all the rucksacks. And I climbed up and we pulled everybody out on a rope, like on a sled with the rucksacks. And there were many miracles in the day. And we survived them. And we got back to Zermatt, and all I had was a scratch on the back of my leg. Everybody else was in hospital and broken necks, all kinds of things. And I realized the rest of life is a privilege. But I also realized in that moment when I thought I was dying, and I did see the tunnel and all the stories like this, that I hadn't actually begun to do whatever it was I came to do. And I still don't know what that means, but I do remember looking down saying, who's going to take care of my dogs? Well, I have to go back. And it's extraordinary what goes on in your mind, and there's no sense of time whatsoever. But to know that you can enter a field where there is no time, and all of these other types of objectivity and rational thought are useless virtually, is a very useful tool for an artist, because so often it's not about logic, it's not about mechanics, it's all the rest, but one has to understand those mechanics. So we got down and we survived this, and I realized that life was going to be different. And that's probably when I started out on the entrepreneurial career as a soloist and took the risk to do what everybody was suggesting. And I didn't worry about not playing in an orchestra any longer, even though that's what bassoonists do. And I realized that I'd had tremendous experiences working with Schulte and Bernstein and Mazel and Durati, and they'd given me great gifts already. It was time to use them in a different way. And that's possibly when I made that transition in looking into all the other types of performers. How do they work? How do they think? And taking other courses in comparative literature and philosophy and religions, etc. The other great epiphany was when I was getting a little carried away with all the success, and I brought my brand new – I had a gold BMW, and I bought a red BMW, and I hadn't even done full tank of gas. A truck lost control and drove straight into me. So the car was totaled. My neck was totaled. My ribs were totaled. But I was – and my memory was gone. And whereas I'd had a close to photographic memory, I could memorize Stockhausen and go up and play it to him, and then we would really talk about what he wanted out of the piece, and I would perform it by memory. And these were some of my little tricks up my sleeve, shall we say. I couldn't remember anything for 20 minutes that day. It was about a week later that Charles Webb called and said, now, Kim, we'd like very much to bring you here to look at this position at Indiana University. I'd been contacted before, and I said, oh, Charles, thank you very much for calling. It's a great honor, but I'm much too busy. I didn't tell him I had this collar on my neck, and I was really busy trying to remember what 2 and 2 were. But I said, I could come in about 2 months. I'm just at my schedule is so busy. I was very careful. I did not lie. I did not say performance schedule. I just said my schedule. But it was a moment, and I had really not considered this position seriously. There was no way I was really going to make this move. And then I sat down and I said, you know, maybe this is why I got hit on the head. Maybe I'm supposed to make a little bit of a change again. And I do love teaching. 2 things are very close to my heart, children and working with young adults. And I love the collegiate area. They're so creative. They're so impossible. They're so unruly. And I love provoking them and nurturing them and making sure that whatever they're inspired with, they apply and focus. And I realized I really enjoy that. So this was really the moment I sat there with this concussion. I said, maybe this is the next corner. Let's see. I'm certainly not going to be performing for 6 months. I came out actually 2.5, 3 months later, and it was one of my first performances, that little interview. So then I walked around this campus and I looked at the trees and I said, this is very special. And somehow it was that intimacy with the nature that the campus has allowed to be a part of everyday life here, I thought was so special, so brilliant. I said, I have to try this. So I'm still here.
Let's hear another piece of music now.
All right.
That was a little heavy.
Oh, dear. Well, let's lighten this up with the Strimpalata by Wolf Ferrari. This is more of a bassoonist jauntiness.
We have just heard the Strimpalata by Wolf Ferrari.
Yes, Wolf Ferrari wrote this wonderful piece, Concerto Notturno and Strimpalata. It's all four tone poems in this wonderful work. Hardly ever played, performed this many times, but this won the BBC Record of the Year. I think it was mostly unusual. People aren't used to hearing bassoon concertos, and this is quite lively.
And that's the London Mozart Players?
London Mozart Players with Jane Glover conducting. We collaborated for many years in London.
You've mentioned the statement, show me, don't tell me. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. I took creative writing when I was in high school, and I realized they just cut out anything that was talking or didactic or any. So really, the whole trick is to show. If I want somebody to play these arpeggios that are running along, I'll explain. It's like a windmill. Just get it going. And all of a sudden, their fingers are running up and down the bassoon like the windmill, and they aren't thinking so much about the technique. Now, they do have to have mastered all the mechanics, but they really have to. And the virtuosity has to be there, but it's there to be spellbinding and show off what the visual image would be for them. And is the piece exciting? Is it inspiring? Is it nurturing? Is it melancholy? Is it dramatic? Is it lyrical? Is this a very powerful statement? Or is this going to be very, you know, transformative and light? You know, what is the music saying, and in what genre and what color are we talking about? Working always in images with the students, with myself, and I grow so much by trying to explain to each person who's walking up this mountain from a different angle which way they might try the best approach.
You seem to do this all with a great sense of humor.
Anybody plays the bassoon seriously for a lifetime. I mean, you have to have a sense of humor.
That was sort of the segue into leading us into this next piece, which shows a great sense of humor.
Well, what you're about to hear is one of the most extraordinary nitroglycerin-type, you know, collaborations of my career. When the Meetham Festival asked me to come, but could I play something as crossover, I said, well, how about a bassoon quartet? And we do all kinds of transcriptions. They said, wonderful. So we ended up with four women bassoonists that we called Queens of the Night. Very seriously, Reine de la Nuit. And we flew down to Cannes and we met Stephanie Grappelli, who walked on stage for a few minutes, and that was put on TV. So we ended up playing at all the most prestigious festivals, thanks to Stephanie Grappelli, not, you know. Anyway, here's our signature tune, Queens of the Night, by Mozart.
From the opera?
He faxed it directly to us, absolutely.
Well, let's hear that as we leave this wonderful opportunity to visit.
Well, thank you, Bob.
You've been listening to Profiles, where we get to meet the person behind the persona. Our guest today has been Kim Walker, virtuoso bassoonist and gifted teacher of master classes at IU and all over the world. She is also associate dean of the faculties and chair of the IU Arts Coordinating Council. Kim, thank you for being with us today.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in January of 2002, Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash, Luann Johnson, research assistant. For WFIU, thanks for listening.